Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We have an entirely musical morning show today. In part two of today's program, you're going to be hearing my interview with Metropolitan Opera star Deborah Voigt, talking about her disarmingly honest and frank memoir called Call Me Debbie. In part one of today's program, I am delighted to welcome back to the program Jessica DeBoer, who is the coordinator of one of the most wonderful performance series here in southeastern Wisconsin, Fine Arts at First. First referring to First United Methodist Church on the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street right here in Kenosha. And I'm sure many of you have enjoyed the various and wonderful offerings which have been part of Fine Arts at First for, how many years?
11
years altogether. And it got started before your time,
yes,
by someone that many people here in town know, David Scripsima. And at some point, he handed it off to you. At what point was that, actually?
This is my fourth season.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, the first season we worked together so he could teach me the ropes. And then from there on, it's, you know, of course, he's certainly there and still has a hand in lots of things. But it's been 4 years now, so
wow,
it's amazing.
Yeah, and it's just incredible, the scope of what's been offered to the community, and it must be a delightful and yet daunting challenge to sort of decide what do we offer next and who do we ask to return and what new things,
yes,
do we experiment with and so on, especially when something is so very, very successful and it just continues to be so incredibly well received.
Yes, that is the biggest problem I have every spring when I sit down to figure out what are we going to have for next season. Because we have so many favorites, you know, people that we love to have back and who have a great following here. But then I just get cold emails from pianists and singers and saying, oh, I've heard about your series. Please have me on your series. And so it's really hard to sit down. And that's actually where David comes in. You know, we have a meeting and we kind of hash out what we have and what we want to have. And then we pare it down and just figure out who's available and that's how we do it. But it is very hard to decide.
Right. Well, you certainly have an exciting season that is stretching before us. And actually, the very first concert is coming up this weekend.
Sunday. Yeah. Yes, ready
so
to get
tell
started.
Us about this spectacular pianist who kicks off Fine Arts at First this year.
Well, we're bringing back Unju Kwok. She was here last in March of 2006. She used to be at Cardinal Stritch up in Milwaukee, right?
Right.
And then, but now she's teaching at Mansfield University in Pennsylvania. So she's coming in for the concert. She's doing some, you know, standard piano works, some Chopin, some Haydn. But then she's also doing a world premiere of a piece by, UW Parkside Professor James Crowley. And that's called Impromptu 4. So he'll be there to talk about his piece. And then closing out her program is a set called Carnival Music by composer George Rochberg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it should be lovely afternoon.
And this is as good a time as any to remind people that First United Methodist has one of the best pianos,
yes,
in southeastern Wisconsin.
And that's really why we started Fine Arts at First, was we were gifted this beautiful 9-foot Bösendorfer concert grand piano, and we thought we have to share this because it really is one of the best pianos in town. And so actually I've kind of made it my thing that I try to start every season with a piano concert because that's just really where we came from. And
that's
so
where it began.
Yes. So I think that's a neat tradition to keep going. So.
Absolutely. Well, it'll be great to have her back for what sounds like a wide-ranging and intriguing,
yes,
program, complete with a world premiere, which,
yes,
is always exciting. As will be your offering in November, which is going to involve a number of different choirs. I don't even know where you're going to put them all.
I know. I'm a little concerned. We're going to have to clear out all the chairs from the choir loft and make room for everybody. We have four choirs. We did this concert 2 years ago. It's sort of an every other year thing. It's called Together in Song. And last time we had just Carthage and Parkside with Professors Peter Dene and James Kinchin. But then this year, and Peter Dene sort of puts this whole thing together. And this year he's invited Lisa Freidenberg from Aurora University and Paul LaPrade from Rock Valley College. And they're each bringing choirs from their schools. And then they're going to come together and do a huge concert featuring the music of American composer Abby Betinas. And she's known for her rounds. And so they have some rounds that they're going to sing together. And they're actually going to invite the audience to sing. So it sounds like a really interesting feature for her, and the composer will be there as well.
Cool. What's the exact date in November?
The date for that is November 15th. And of course, all of our concerts start at 3 p.m. Of course, well, except for the Messiah. But that's our one concert that's in the evening, but 3 o'clock on November 15th.
Very good. So, speaking of Messiah, it comes up on the 20th of December.
Yes, absolutely. It's our flagship concert. Really, we have it every year. We love it. It's so beautiful in the sanctuary with the lights and the candles. And it's just one concert that I know so many people look forward to. Not only people in the audience, but people who play in the orchestra. They look forward every year. I just sent out the email yesterday saying, oh, here's when Messiah is. Who's going to come play? And everyone is saying, me.
Yeah.
Because it's really such a fun concert.
That's a nice sign when there are people who have that level of excitement about being part of it.
Yes,
let alone the people who come to actually sing in it and actually make it happen. So Sunday evening, 6 p.m., the 20th of December. Then coming up in February, so somehow you managed to take a month off there.
I know. Well, we took October off too. You know, we can't. It's hard to fit in one every month, not only because it just makes our schedule so full, but with all of the promotional things that we have to do.
Oh, of course.
It just takes extra time.
Yeah, so. Right. And it makes us.
And the holidays, you know, it's crazy.
Absolutely. What makes us appreciate each and every one then.
Yeah, that's it.
So coming up in February, a concert which also plans to be especially wonderful and interesting because everything that this group does is wonderful and interesting.
Absolutely. We're bringing back the Fifth House Ensemble. They are the main piece that they're doing for that concert is Schoenberg's Verklärte Nacht, an arrangement of it. And I say Schoenberg, and I don't want people to go, oh, no, not Schoenberg. That's so weird. I don't want to go to that. But it's, you know, Schoenberg wrote that piece before he really got into his 12-tone composition.
Right.
That was about 12 years before. So it's not what you might think of as a weird modern piece at all.
No, it's actually lush and gorgeous.
Absolutely.
And Verklärte Nacht means transfigured night. And it's an extraordinarily beautiful work, which nevertheless does not get done all that often.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, I don't recall it being done by either of the area symphonies, not within recent memory anyway.
Mm-mm.
So kind of a treat to hear one of the true masterpieces of the 20th century. Tell our listeners who maybe aren't specifically acquainted with Fifth House, what makes them such a great group?
They're really unique in that they have a huge group of people that they draw from who are members of the group. You know, they have violinists and violists and flutes and oboes and, you know, sort of one of everything. And they can really pick and choose what they perform because they can say, oh, yeah, flute, oboe, bassoon, sure, we got that. We can do that. Or violin, French horn, clarinet, yeah, okay, we can do that because we have one of everybody. And they also are, they really champion new compositions. They host the Fresh Ink Festival every spring out at UW-Parkside. And
right.
So they are really... they commission works all the time, and they get new pieces for their ensemble to perform. And so they're really sort of just a really interesting way of approaching chamber music, that they can sort of do it all because they have everybody in their employ, and more than just string quartets. You know, that's sort of you know, or wind quintet, you know, those are nice. But here we have all of these interesting pieces for random instruments that they can do because they have all those people.
Absolutely. And I remember in interviewing Melissa Snowden last year, Snowza before their most recent Fresh Ink, mm-hmm. she was also talking about how this group, which is, by the way, based in Chicago,
right.
how they also have really delighted in doing what they do, performing chamber music in all kinds of intriguing settings. I mean, besides the standard recital halls and concert halls and so on, I mean, they really take music into some unexpected places and play it often for kind of unexpected occasions.
Oh,
I mean, it's really intriguing how much they have thought outside the box, and yet it's not just about gimmicks. It's about sublime music making on top of it.
Right.
So there's so many things to admire about Fifth House.
Well, I'd say we could have that concert out on the lawn, but since it's February, I don't think that would be such a good idea.
Maybe not. So what's the date of that?
That's actually on Valentine's Day, February 14. So,
for goodness sake.
It's in the afternoon. You can come to the concert and then take your sweetheart out for dinner. And
there you
know,
go.
Won't interfere with your plans. And it's free. That's even better.
Mm. Well, and this the aforementioned piece that's kind of the highlight of the program, Verklärtenacht, is a very romantic
Absolutely.
Piece. So that's actually a great choice. Coming up in March, a group that I know a lot of people have probably heard of, and I so enjoy this past year going to two different concerts up in Milwaukee
yep.
by the Mastersingers. Tell us more about them.
The Mastersingers of Milwaukee are coming on March 13th. Their director is, of course, Eduardo Garcia Novelli, who is out at Carthage as well. And they are doing a program called A Journey of the Sounds of the Americas. That's sort of hard to say. And they're doing two masses. One is by a Mexican Baroque composer, Juan Gutierrez de Padilla. And so that was certainly written a long time ago. But then they're also doing a mass by a living composer, an Argentinian. And his piece is called Mass from Two Worlds. And it's Ariel Quintana is the composer. And he's an Argentinian-American. And so it's an interesting look at the same structure of a piece, but written in two different, very different time periods. And so, you know, because composers of that era, of certainly the Baroque era, we think, of course, of Bach and Handel and all of these Europeans, and we forget a lot of times that there are composers around the world writing music. And so it'll be interesting to hear a piece by an American, a Latin American composer from that time period.
Absolutely. This is a terrific group, and they sort of have culled some of the very best singers from various groups around Milwaukee. These are, in some ways, the all-stars
mm-hmm.
of singers in Milwaukee, and an absolutely terrific group. And Dr. Garcia Novelli's done stupendous things
yes.
with them since taking them over a few years ago. And so it's be fun to finally have them coming to town.
They've done, I think they do a lot of work with the mass. The last concert I heard of theirs was a mass, and every single movement was by a different composer. And they went through all the way to the end, and then they went backwards back to the beginning of the mass. So it was sort of an interesting look at that. So I think it's neat that they're doing another mass program, but this time in a different way with different composers from different eras. So.
Terrific. So that's the 13th of March,
yes.
the Mastersingers of Milwaukee. And then in April, something that must be especially thrilling
yes,
for you.
Yes, I'm excited. Well, as a string player, right, I'm really excited. April 17, we're bringing Frank Almond. He's the concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony, and he's coming to do a recital. And I have a little connection with him, unbeknownst to me until very recently. When his violin was stolen a few years ago, and that whole story broke, my grandma called me. And my grandma lives in San Diego, and she says, "Did you hear about this?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, of course. We know this is front page news." And she said, "Well, I am friends with his father, with Frank Almond's father. Apparently." His father just recently retired. He was the choral professor at San Diego State University. My grandfather was a voice professor at San Diego State University. So they were colleagues.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And I had no idea. And so, you know, she said, yes. And I see him every month. We have a gathering of friends every month. And I see him. And we, you know, we're friends. And so I just thought that was really neat. And so when I thought to reach out to him to come do a concert, you know, I sent him information, and I said, well, I know my grandma would be really upset with me if I didn't tell you this connection. And so he replied that he would love to come and play, and he said, oh, yes, I knew your grandfather. I went to high school with your uncle. So,
oh,
you know,
my
gosh. It's a small world.
Wow. Well, I do remember that that he was from California.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I remember a lot being made of that for some reason the first time he came and soloed with the Racine Symphony. And then I've had the pleasure of interviewing him several times over the years, including before he played at Carthage not too long ago, right. As part of a special recital tour to celebrate, I believe, the 300th anniversary of his own violin.
Amazing.
I mean, that precious violin that had been stolen and thankfully returned.
Yes.
But anyway, it was great to talk with him, but I hadn't heard that he had a choir director for a father.
Yes, and he is also Frank Allman, so actually, you know, Frank, it's confusing to keep it all straight in your head, but yeah absolutely.
So tell our listeners more about what makes Frank Allman such a special artist.
He, you know, he's not only an orchestral player, a concert master, obviously he's mastered that, but he is also a recitalist. And a lot of times you don't, you know, it's not necessarily something that they both do or that a person might do both of them. And so it's just it'll just be a nice chance for you to hear him play a solo, you know, in a solo setting, as opposed to going to hear the MSO play and just seeing him, you know, as the orchestral player. So, you know, that'll be I've heard him do orchestral concertos, you know, you hear him do that, but in a recital setting, that's more, you know, a unique thing.
Right. And to have them up close. And,
right.
I know when he played at Carthage, he spoke before every piece and did such a good job of kind of setting the stage. And it was a remarkable night. And I'm sure this will be a great, great day. What's the date again in April?
April 17th.
April 17th. Frank Allman, concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony. And if all of that wasn't enough,
I'm ambitious this year. We're doing 7 concerts as opposed to our usual 6.
Wow.
And that all goes back to not being able to decide what to have.
Right, right. So tell us about the High Note on which all of this ends in May.
Yes, the Fine Arts Jazz Ensemble. I cannot say enough good things about that group. Mike Gudbauer is the director of that group, and he just pulls together all of his friends, his amazing musician friends who come every year, and they just play incredibly well. It's wonderful. And this year's focus is called Jazz for All Seasons. We're sort of doing this every other year. We have a 1 year will feature a specific artist. We've done Benny Goodman. That was our last one.
Right.
And then the opposite year we do sort of a focus on specific tunes that fit a topic. So we had pop or jazz goes the pop, you know, pop music and jazz sort of coming together. And so this year's topic is Jazz for All Seasons. And so they're going to do tunes that have to deal with the seasons, autumn in New York, summertime, I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm, all of those seasonal topic jazz tunes.
Great idea.
So a nice mix of composers and styles and tunes.
Super.
They are amazing.
And speaking of all-stars, Mike ends up gathering some of the very, very best jazz artists in the area.
Yes.
Some of whom never get to really play together in this particular configuration until they come together for this, and which sort of adds some electricity to the air.
It does. It's just, they just blow the roof off the place, you know.
How exciting.
It's great.
So, 7 concerts in all. The first coming up this coming Sunday afternoon at 3:00 with Yoon Jun Kwak.
Yes.
And then the choirs in November, Messiah in December, Fifth House in February, the Master Singers in March, violinist Frank Allman in April, and of course finishing up with jazz in May of next year. And of course, what's especially remarkable about all this is that these concerts are free and
they
open
are.
To the public.
Absolutely. That is our mission, to bring quality classical music to everybody. Everybody. It's free for everybody. There's no tickets. You don't have to worry about that. You just come, show up, and enjoy wonderful music. You know, there's a lot of free concerts, but these ones, you know, they're just such high quality.
Right.
And I'm so proud to be able to do that. And, you know, it wouldn't be possible without our very loyal group of supporters who, you know, they send in money every year, and that just makes it all possible.
Hmm.
And so we're just very grateful to be able to do that year after year.
Extraordinary. Remind people of the website address if people
sure.
want to get reminded of things coming up
right.
and so on.
You can go check out our lineup. It's at fineartsatfirst.org, everything spelled out. That's fineartsatfirst.org. And you can also like us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page, and I promise I don't fill your news feed with lots of stuff. But when it's concert time, you'll get a reminder that, you know, concert's coming up on Sunday, and that's another way to get connected with us.
Excellent. And again, that next concert, that first concert of this new season, is this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Yep.
Jessica DeBoer, we thank you for joining us today on The Morning Show. How exciting to have a new season ahead of us, and we trust that a lot of people are going to seek out this opportunity
yes,
to
I hope so.
Hear some great, great music right here in Kenosha at First United Methodist Church on the corner of 60th Street and Sheridan Road. Thanks for being here for part one of today's Morning Show.
Thank you for having me.
And here is part two. That extraordinarily beautiful voice and impassioned singing is courtesy of one of America's most highly regarded opera stars, Deborah Voight. And Deborah Voight has just penned a really extraordinary memoir about her amazing life and career called Call Me Debbie, True Confessions of a Down-to-Earth Diva, in which she recounts with disarming frankness the life she has led as a very, very celebrated opera star, but also some of the travails that have been part of her personal life, some of which have been fairly well known and publicized up until now, and others really probably not ever revealed, certainly not with such clarity or completeness until now with the publication of this book. And I'm very, very excited to be able to speak with Deborah Voight about her memoir, which is published by HarperCollins, again called Call Me Debbie, True Confessions of a Down-to-Earth Diva. Deborah Voight, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
I'm excited to be speaking with you. I've enjoyed your singing all these years on many occasions from your many recordings and a number of performances you've delivered at the Lyric Opera of Chicago. And, of course, many people listening to these interviews also appreciate your vibrant presence on various HD simulcasts on many occasions as a singer and in many occasions as on-screen host. I wonder if you could say a word about the frankness of this memoir, and in particular the fact that you are so open about some of your own vulnerabilities that I'm sure a lot of people are not going to expect before they actually begin reading the book. From the start, from the get-go, was it always going to be that kind of memoir, or did it, in a sense, did it become that as you wrote it?
It really evolved from the first moment that I thought about writing a book, which would have been after my very public firing from the Royal Opera House in London and subsequent weight loss. And I decided that I would think about writing a book at that time because I had achieved a certain level of notoriety within my field of singing. And I felt that I had a story to tell about weight and the issues that are related to it. There's certainly many, many people that can identify with that particular subject. But as I began the process of writing this book, I started to feel as though it wasn't the right time. It felt as though something was brewing up in my personal, emotional life that was going to have to be dealt with. And also professionally, I knew that there were still roles ahead of me, Brunhilde, for example, that were going to be major parts of my career and that I would have more to say artistically down the road. And as it evolved over the course of 4 or 5 years, there certainly was more to both stories, my personal life as well as my professional life.
You write with great honesty about your relationship with your family and your parents in particular. How difficult was that? And I mean, did you feel like you were, in a sense, writing this honestly, this frankly, kind of walking on eggshells with major trepidation? Or do you have the kind of relationship with them now that you could kind of talk about everything as openly as you ultimately do?
Well, the relationship I have with my parents now is open, and I can speak with them about anything that's going on in my life. That being said, I was walking on eggshells pretty much the whole time I was writing the book. And some of that had to do with my relationship with my parents and how discipline and religious outlooks happened in my household at that time. But really, when it comes down to it, I outed myself more than anybody else. And if I threw anybody under the bus, it would be me. So I think I know that they have been very accepting and very warm. You know, of course, my mother made the comment to me that she wished that I had written about the happier moments in my childhood. And of course, there were many, many happy moments in my childhood. But in telling a story that included the topic of addiction, one has to look at the reasons behind that. You know, what are the character defects? What was the emotional climate of a household or a relationship between parents that led to particular behaviors down the road, which is not a way of saying that it was their fault or that they did something wrong. But it's hard to write your story if you're going to write an honest story and leave out the bits that are perhaps uncomfortable to your family members or to your ex-husband or to yourself.
Hmm. You write about turmoil of a couple of different varieties in your childhood, and one of them sort of surrounded the issue of food. You open one chapter with these words: "For my entire childhood, my mother was on a diet." Explain what your mother's relationship was with food and how you think now, I mean, looking back with the wisdom of long life, what kind of impact that ultimately had on you, even if you didn't understand it at the time?
Well, my mother was always on a diet, as you say, and as I wrote about, and part of that had to do with her own insecurities about her figure. Part of that had to do with a husband who was very aware of every morsel that went in her mouth and mine subsequently. And I think that came from perhaps the fact that his mother had been a woman who struggled with weight. But yes, my mom was dieting constantly, nonstop, and certainly had a strange relationship to food, which I inherited, the same sort of struggle with weight. And ironically enough, when it came time to put the pictures together for my book, my mother and I were together, and we were looking at pictures of us over the course of that time when I was young and in high school, and we were both shocked at how wonderful we looked, that I was not a heavy girl. I was a voluptuous girl. I had we'll just leave it at that. I was a voluptuous girl. And I think that became confusing to me, probably to my dad to a certain extent, in wanting the best for me and, you know, looking out for me. And let's not let, you know, those curvaceous hips become a really fat rear end. So at the same time, there were the clean plate contests in our home. You know, you kids are going to finish your food because there's starving children in Africa and, you know, that sort of thing. So there was a very mixed message about food and my relationship to it from the time I was a little girl. And it remains still an issue. I'm struggling right now. I would like to get 20 pounds off. And I wake up every day and say, okay, today's the day. And, you know, by 3 o'clock, I'm ready to eat the couch. So I don't think it'll ever go away.
Right. The other issue of real paramount importance is the fact that you were brought up in a very strict, conservative, religious home. And And it was also a bit of a complication when it came to the place that music was going to have in your life. Talk about that dynamic in the home in which you grew up, and particularly how it related to you being a musician and a singer.
Well, I think that I know that from a very, very young age, even as young as 4 or 5, I had already discovered musicals. And when I would go to my grandparents' house, all I wanted to do was dress up and dance around the living room and entertain everyone. And I think that my parents didn't quite know what to make of me. You know, they thought, where did this very precocious little child come from? Because they didn't have that kind of background or that kind of relationship to music, although my mother did sing. And my first experiences singing publicly were in church, and that seemed to be acceptable. But I think that they had a difficult time with my moving from sacred to secular music. And I understand that to a certain extent. I mean, I think that they thought if our daughter has such a magnificent talent, it has been given to her by God, which I believe as well, and that it should be used for his purposes. And that it ended up being something that is not of a religious nature, although some of the characters that I sing are certainly religious. I think of Minnie as being one of my favorites. And, you know, she quotes from the Bible to the minors. But that's, I think, something that took a long time for my parents to kind of get a hold of. I remember when I first started to sing professionally, it took me a while to get the fact that my parents were in the audience out of my head as a performer. I still felt very aware. And, you know, by that time, any concern that they would have had about my choices in being a woman of the theater were probably over. But, you know, the things that are in our heads as children, the tapes that run over and over and over, take a very, very long time to reset and for another message to go to your head.
I know that you write with great honesty about this very dramatic moment in your life when you heard the proverbial voice that really urged you on to sing, despite the fact that, you know, in some ways that's not really who you are. I mean, you are a very down-to-earth human being and not prone to having those particular kind of experiences, or in some way it seems not exactly who you are versus some people who seem to hear voices all the time. But I mean, you really did hear a voice and don't mind telling us, and it made a very, very big difference. But you also heard, in a sense, that same message that you must sing in the voice of others who were important people in your life. Talk about that.
Well, I did have this, you know, experience when I was probably 14, where I felt very clearly that I heard the voice of God tell me that that is what I'm meant to do, to sing. It was not thunderbolts and lightning clouds and angels coming down out of the sky. It was something very quiet and intimate, and I can only imagine that that's what it was. It's the only thing that made any sense, and I have always believed it, and yet I didn't talk about it for a long time. You would have thought that an experience like that would have been something I would have run to my very religious parents with, but I didn't. I kept it quiet for probably another 10 years when I finally told a teacher of mine that I had had this experience, and then I didn't talk about it again until I wrote the book. I think, unfortunately, people have very skewed impressions of people who have religion in their lives or who would describe themselves as being Christian. And we get a bad reputation, we Christians, for the reasons of a few, not the masses. You know, just because I feel that I heard the voice of God and because I have a very strong relationship with God, or try to, does not mean that I don't think that my gay friends should be married or that a woman should have choice over anything that she does with her body. But I think people get put into categories, and that's really unfortunate. And, you know, yes, I'm a diva, okay, whatever that means. But I know plenty of divas that are on their knees in their dressing room before a performance asking for help.
I appreciated the fact, and maybe it's partly because I am also a voice teacher in my life, so I appreciated how much you talked about the really great training that you received early in life. I especially enjoyed in your description of your studies with a woman by the name of Jane Paul at California State University, the way in which Rice Krispies, of all things, would sometimes be evoked in voice lessons. Could you share that with our listeners?
Well, during the, I'm going to probably get this wrong, but I think it was maybe the 70s, there was a commercial on television for Rice Krispies, and it was a family sitting around the table eating breakfast when they realized that they didn't have any more Rice Krispies. And the father, I believe, of the family began to sing, "No more Rice Krispies." And it was very dramatic. And if you Google Rice Krispies, and I think it was the aria from Pagliacci, I don't remember. But to find it. And it was very overly dramatic and kind of ridiculous. But nonetheless, that was the thing that Jane would say to me when she needed me to try and connect a little bit more with the words. She'd say, "I need more Rice Krispies." And I knew exactly what she meant.
Your book goes on, of course, to talk about the many triumphs which you ultimately enjoyed all over the world at nearly every major opera company around the world. And you recount many of your experiences with various directors and other singers and conductors and so on. We know you particularly from interviews and your on-screen presence as a host, as being, as I said earlier, a very affable, down-to-earth kind of person, in some respects contrary to the notion that a lot of us have about what an operatic diva is supposed to be. Are you really kind of a rare exception, or in fact, if we looked pretty closely at most people in your line of work, are there a fair amount of Debbie Voights out there that we just don't realize are there, or is that personality that you have kind of exceptional in the world in which you work?
Well, of course, I'd like to say that there are, of course, no other Debbie Voights out there, but that would not be very down-to-earth diva of me. I think that, as I mentioned, these preconceived ideas about opera, I think there were the days when a sort of grandness and perhaps a bit of a difficult behavior was accepted, expected. I don't think that's the case much anymore because the world has become so competitive in opera, and if someone's going to behave terribly badly, they will find themselves out of a job, because there will be someone else who can sing it as well and not be a pain in the rear. But I do think that, if I may blow my own horn a bit, I do think that I have something in my personality, and I have known this from the time that I was a child, that elicited a response from an audience. When I was a little girl and was singing in church, I didn't understand this, but looking back at it now, I think what got me so excited was that I knew I was communicating something to an audience that they heard and that they understood and that they related to. And I have felt that way throughout my life, whether it be on an opera stage or in a recital or a musical or American Songbook. And I don't know that that's something that can be taught. In fact, I know it can't be taught because I've done enough teaching now to realize that there are certain aspects of performers that are engaging on stage that make us want to hear more about them or want to know more about them. And that's something that is not taught easily in a rehearsal room or in a studio. I love the fact that I am able to do the HD performances, not only as a singer, but even more so as a host, because part of my frustration in being an opera singer, I'm extremely grateful, of course, but it's a little frustrating when you have a personality that you want to share, when you are limited in what you can express because you're playing roles that are so iconic that have been done throughout the generations by lots of singers and you're constantly compared to them, it makes it difficult for my audience to know me. And throughout the course of writing my book, that kept going through my head. And part of the things that I'm exploring in terms of this one-woman show I have called Voight Lessons is an opportunity for the audience to know me, Debbie Voight, not Deborah Voight, the Brunhilde that has recently, you know, arrived on the scene.
You also write, of course, about addiction, particularly something that I think most of us had no inkling had entered your life, namely the really scary specter of abuse of alcohol. I wonder, first of all, was it difficult, was it painful to kind of revisit some of those moments in your life? And to any extent, was it a help to you to actually revisit some of those experiences? And did you find yourself making better sense of them as you wrote about them?
It was difficult to write about those moments. There's no question about it. And during the course of writing my story, I thought, oh, I can't talk about that. I can't share that experience. I can't talk about bad relationships. I can't talk about blackouts. And the thing of it was that the more I got into it, the more I thought, if you're going to tell your story, Debbie, you have to tell your story. And that's the good, the bad, and the ugly. And yeah, it was difficult to talk about those things, but ultimately, the thing that I learned the most about myself during the course of writing the book is that I have a tremendous amount of resilience that I was not aware of. There would be issues in my life, like the firing from the little black dress or going through a particularly horrible breakup, when I knew that I was able to pull up my boots and get back on stage and go for it. But when you look at a lifetime of these kinds of experiences, it was pretty daunting. And I kept thinking, and still do, how did you do this? How did you manage to have this incredible career but be dealing with some very serious issues, as you mentioned, the addiction to alcohol? Fortunately, the window of time that was really, really a problem was narrow by comparison to the weight issues or the romantic issues. But nonetheless, they were there. And, you know, alcoholism and addiction affects every person, or rather people of all walks of life. And I thought that was an important part of my life to talk about. I didn't know how not to talk about it, to be honest.
Well, fortunately, as your book recounts, you've arrived at a very happy, whole place, let's say. And what is ahead for you?
Well, I'm of course going to maintain my operatic career, but I'm hoping that I can do a little bit more American songbook sort of music, concerts. A lot of concerts, a lot of recitals. I want to keep doing this one-woman show, Voight Lessons, just premiered in New York a week ago and was very successful. So it's some teaching. But I'm ready to do more of what Debbie wants to do and less of what the operatic world expects me to do or would like me to do. You know, I've sung pretty much all of the repertoire that I want to sing or that I should sing within the Fach that I am. The only exception would maybe be Elektra, Strauss's Elektra, and I don't think that's going to happen, unfortunately. The opportunity has come up a couple times and fallen through no fault of mine, so that's kind of a bummer. But other than that, I have been really, really lucky and really blessed, especially for someone who didn't start out even knowing what the Metropolitan Opera was, let alone becoming one of its stars. So it's all been a really interesting journey, and, you know, we'll see what the next part of the road is.
Well, you have done a wonderful job of putting this complicated and compelling story together just beautifully in this wonderful memoir called Call Me Debbie, True Confessions of a Down-to-Earth Diva. And I hasten to add that, although I think those of us who are opera fans and have been fans of your singing obviously read this book with great relish, but even someone not particularly interested in the world of opera would find a lot of this story tremendously compelling. The book is published by HarperCollins. Deborah Voigt, thank you so much for joining me today. Very best wishes to you and all that stretches ahead for you.
Thanks so much. It was my pleasure. Have a great day.
The time is 8:57 here on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I look forward to a visit from a Carthage colleague, Dr. Thomas Carr, who heads up the paleontology program there. And Dr. Carr is going to be joining me in the studio to talk about his most recent dinosaur digs out west and some of the other exciting things that he has been up to. We have a very busy Thursday morning show planned as well. It will include a visit from Jim Wardrop from Preservation Racine, talking about their tour of historic places, which is coming up this weekend. And we also will be hearing from folks from the Racine Literacy Council and from Racine Reads during Thursday's program, I believe. On Friday's morning show, I'm so excited to be talking with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage, who pays us a visit, of course, once a month to offer his analysis of current events. And coming up on Monday, a program I am very, very excited about, I'm going to be talking with a gentleman by the name of Simon Goodman, whose book is called The Orpheus Clock. Mr. Goodman is part of a family connected in a very tragic way with the Holocaust, and some of his ancestors had their considerable fortune essentially wiped out by the Nazis. And particularly unfortunate is how the Nazis took hold of the family's priceless art collection. Well, Mr. Goodman in recent years has been working tirelessly to try to see that at least some of those beautiful works of art are returned to the family, and rightfully so. And he writes the story of his family and of this quest in an extraordinary book called The Orpheus Clock. And you'll hear my interview with him on Monday's morning show. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. We have a sunny day ahead with a high of 75 degrees, overnight low of 55 degrees, and sunshine expected to be with us now through Monday, actually. And daytime temperatures should remain in the mid-70s throughout the weekend into early next week. Glorious, glorious autumn weather. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. And